You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Monday, February 19th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca, and it's President's Day. Man, do I love the presidents. I love the presidents. I love Stephen Bandrowczak, the president of Xerox. Bandrowczak, B-A-N-D-R-O-W-C-Z-A-K. I love David McLean. He was the president of the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, the parent organization that put that together. He started as president of the Dick the Bruiser fan club, the professional wrestler Dick the Bruiser. I don't think it had all of the suggestivity back then in the 50s that it might now. Also, I found out about David McLean. He tried to launch the Triple Crown of Polo when he was president of, I suppose, that organization. Another president I love is, of course, Mary Papazian, president of San Jose University. But I think on this day, we mostly celebrate a different sort of president, the presidents of the United States. I know I have in the past, and so I shall bring you two great interviews that consider not just a president, but all the presidents and rank them. My guests back in 2019 were Brian Lamb and Susan Swain of each of C-SPAN. Love C-SPAN, love Lamb. And they were there talking about the presidents. Noted historians rank America's best and worst chief executives. That's fun. But what are the standards to rank the presidents? Strength in war, stewardship of the economy. And that brings me to my other interview. This one took place in March of 2018. I talked to Kate and J.D. Dobson, and they were out with a book called The Hottest Heads of State. They consider the quiet charisma of Ulysses S. Grant, Franklin Pierce's youthful charm, the distinguished eyebrows of Warren G. Harding. Yes, the Dobsons are the authors of The Hottest Heads of State, Volume 1, The American President. I don't know that there was a sequel. I do know that when they came by for an interview, they gave me a Theodore Roosevelt candle, and I still light it up and enjoy its musky scent, much like Theodore Roosevelt himself. Enjoy these interviews on this, our President's Day.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
All right, we're counting down the top 43 chief executives of the United States. Starting with James Buchanan all the way up to number one, Abraham Lincoln. We're right now on number 37. Coming in with a bullet, it's Millard Fillmore. All right, would that be more exciting than what I've got before me, which is a book called The Presidents, Noted Historians Rank America's Best and Worst Chief Executives? I think not, because The Presidents is put together by the brain trust that runs C-SPAN, and C-SPAN has been ranking the presidents for years, and how some of these rankings have changed is quite interesting, as is the contents of the book. It is based on interviews that Brian Lamb of C-SPAN did with noted presidential biographers. The editor of this book is Susan Swain. Brian and Susan are here with me. Thank you for joining me, guys.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, Mike.
So let's start. I'm sure this is where everyone starts, but fine. Chester A. Arthur. I think he's unfairly maligned. Here's my case for Chester A. Arthur. You know, you only have to be president in the time that you have to be president. Abraham Lincoln had a great war upon him. George Washington, of course, was the father of the country and the first president. Given the job that Chester A. Arthur was handed, I think he left the country better off. If I had to file a performance review of Chester A. Arthur, it would be quite a glowing review. I think he exceeded expectations. Do you agree or disagree?
Absolutely. I think we ought to say up front that the most important part of this book, Mike, are the authors of these books that we interviewed. It's really a book about presidents and historians more than it is a book about ratings. The ratings thing is fun to do, but in the end, all of these individuals deserve credit for having led the country.
So two of the presidents who've had reassessments, not just from your panel of historians, but historians in general, are Andrew Jackson and Ulysses S. Grant. And the reason for the reassessments is similar. It's mostly in the treating of African Americans, or even broader than that, in Jackson's case, Native Americans, African Americans. And my question is that fair in terms of history, or is that more a reflection of the current mores of our time?
Well, of course, we can really only judge them through our own eyes. I mean, that's understandable. And one of the things, even in the 20 years that we've been doing this survey, watching certain presidents go up and down, it's because our society has been changing so much during that period of time that the lens through which historians, even though they have some sort of professional distance in the process, they're human. And they're reading new biographies that are coming out and working off of new papers. But around them, our own standards are changing. And so how we view these presidents and their performance has to be colored by that to some degree. You know, one of the categories, we did 10 categories in this survey, which was developed by presidential historians. And one of them was performance within the context of their times.
Yeah.
And that was intentionally added to give them a bit of a pass, I'd say, for the fact that the presidency was very different in the time in which they served and the country was very different.
Also, Mike, on Ulysses S. Grant, I can't even speak. There have been four or five major books written in the last 10 years.
One of them. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Turnout. Ronald S. White did a brilliant book a year before Turnout did. There's also the John Marsalek. It's annotated memoir, and it goes on and on. There are many other Grant books. They seem to have had also a major impact on his image.
Yes. And I do think that we have begun to, I mean, this is my opinion, but we've begun to rightly prioritize that one category that you had, which is, how do you guys put it, treating Americans as equals?
Yes. In fact, we do. It's pursued equal justice for all.
Right.
So several of the presidents, include Jackson, you mentioned, is one of them. But also Rutherford Hayes, his rating has gone down. And I think he is tarred with ending, you know, the South after the Civil War, bringing the troops back home. And actually, the circumstances surrounding that decision were much more complicated when you read history about it, but is his reputation during his presidency. Another one is Grover Cleveland. And Cleveland, you'll learn in our chapter on him, really had a pretty poor record on race issues. So I think there are several presidents, again, judging through contemporary society when people are looking at them, that say, hey, they didn't do so well.
Brian, I know that you served in the, generally speaking, you were like a body man for LBJ, but Eisenhower was very much present in your lifetime. You thought about him. Are you surprised that he's so well regarded by history? He's the fifth greatest president, according to the historians in your book.
I am not surprised based on what I felt about him when I was young. The only part about him that I do remember, I mean, I remember him being in the public media. There are two things that he was known as being boring. And so that often is the wrong way to judge anything. The other thing was he had serious health problems, a couple heart attacks. He was in the hospital a lot, but those were eight fairly peaceful years. And so it depends on, again, what is it you want? You can, being fifth, I don't think in terms of where presidents belong, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. I don't judge them based on where they fit in this survey. So he was a solid American, successful president with one major scandal, his chief of staff, and otherwise, you know, pretty successful time.
Brian, How many presidential biographies would you say you've read in your life?
Well, I can tell you that he's read 43 of them.
At least, right?
Right, because they're interviews. All in the book. Yeah, right.
Well, in the case of Grant, I've read three or four. By the way, I love reading them. I'm not a historian, and I don't consider myself an expert in any of this. It's just really fun to get to know the country through these characters. I did something that is very strange. Most people would look at me like I'm crazy, and I might be. But I went to all the grave sites of all the presidents, and then I followed up by going to all the grave sites of all the vice presidents.
Wow.
And, yeah, people go, really? Get a day job. Do something. But it was a great teaching tool for me because I kind of, you know, I get a feeling for where they are in the country and what the atmosphere was and all that stuff. And along the way, you learn a lot. But it's I just remember back as you were talking about President, my father really didn't like I don't know if the word hate is it, but didn't like Harry Truman.
Huh.
And if he were alive today, he would love Harry Truman. Because Truman is very popular in our survey, and when it's one of the most interesting lives of all the presidents. And he doesn't get talked about much, but when you get into it, he really made decisions and was strong about his decisions. And he's just got one of the most interesting stories of any of them.
And what's amazing about Truman is it really demonstrates the impact that one book can have on a president's reputation.
That's true.
David McCullough. Really, had people revisiting his presidency because he was really very unpopular when he left office.
When you talk to the biographers, do you get the sense, it is usual, and Cherno even admits this, that he wouldn't want to spend time with someone he didn't like.
Yeah,
and then there's
right.
a little bit of a Stockholm syndrome where if you spend so much time, you perhaps begin to see the good in that person. So do you notice an inclination for most biographers to like their subjects? And then in terms of an honest assessment, what do you do, for instance, say, Brian, when you're interviewing those biographers?
Well, Brian, talk about Robert Caro, because you've done four at least major interviews with him, and all of his adult life almost has been spent in the study of one president. But he's not in love with him.
I don't want to be flip about this because Robert Caro is a man that everybody is interested in biography knows, and they have their very strong positive feelings about the work he's done. I don't think he's made up his mind what he thinks about Lyndon Johnson. I think that's part of his struggle to get the last of the five books out. Mm. He knows he doesn't like what he did in Vietnam, but he hasn't written that part of it yet. He knows he loves what he's done with civil rights, and he's written that. So, you know, it depends on the person. Some of these people are totally in love with their subject. It's an important part of studying a biographer, and when you read these books, you need to dip farther than what's on that paper to get some idea of why they felt so strongly to spend as long as, sometimes as much as 14, 15 years. One of our special people in this book is Richard Norton Smith, who's a historian that's written books from George Washington to Colonel McCormick, the former owner of the Chicago Tribune, is currently working on the definitive biography of Gerald R. Ford. And I've never asked Richard whether he loves or likes or hates. I know he doesn't dislike him because he did the eulogy at his funeral. So
yeah, and he'd also be the first person ever to dislike Gerald Ford. Yeah.
That's a very good point. But he is fussing over Gerald Ford right now,
yeah.
going through 25 chapters to write about his life. And he's just fascinated, as close as he was to him, he's just fascinated by what he's finding about his ordinary beginning, extraordinary life that most people don't know about, to what he was as a president. So it varies. It depends on the situation. But you need to go beyond just reading the book. You need to think through whether or not a biographer really hates or likes who they're writing about.
Your question reminds me of the Bill Clinton chapter. We used David Marinus's biography, First in His Class, as the basis for that chapter. And the very last paragraph in our chapter from Brian's interview really speaks to this. He says, "The hardest thing was to decide in my own mind what I felt about this guy. I'd go back and forth violently because there were chapters in his life where I liked him and chapters where I didn't. So I would beat myself up saying, 'Make up your mind, you've got to decide.' And then I realized he's a dual person and I had it right."
Yeah, yeah. Ambivalence is sometimes a great narrative force if you're masterful enough to be able to communicate that to the reader. Let me ask you a couple C-SPAN questions. 40th anniversary, and I love C-SPAN. Do you think that, I've heard you in interviews say this, that your coverage of the correspondence dinner, especially putting it on C-SPAN and seeing Seth Meyers make jokes and seeing Donald Trump get upset with this, do you give some credence to that, the idea that that might be one of the things that inspired him to run for president?
Everybody writes this. We've never said it. That was some video that has been used many, many times of Trump sitting at the table and President Obama working him over in the crowd. But who knows? I think more than anything, the vision that the country has gotten about the White House Correspondents' Dinner has not worked to the benefit of the correspondents. And I've been in this town for 53 years. I don't go to them anymore. I'll never go to another one if I don't have to for some reason. I don't think that that's what journalists should be doing. Never did. But I think it's important for the country to see what it's like. 3,000 people all dressed up in a room. Their sources are there. There's a lot of drinking that goes on. It's just not a healthy environment if you call yourself a journalist.
And they've tried to go back to basics this year by having Ron Chernow speak. Because they were doing some self-examination. But you know that scene that you describe would have happened whether or not a camera was in the room. There were 11 or 1,200 people who mattered to Donald Trump and to President Obama at the time who all would have heard those same jokes. So the question is, did the camera make a difference, or really was it the – if this scenario is as influential as people write, would it have happened simply by virtue of them being in that setting, camera or no camera?
I interviewed a friend of mine, Steve Kornacki, who wrote a book, The Red and the Blue, The 1990s and the Birth of Political Tribalism. He's not the first to put this forward, but he really emphasizes and underlines the importance of C-SPAN in the rise of Newt Gingrich, how he used C-SPAN and the fact that they would just televise his speeches on whatever, and he used that as a platform to help gain power. Do you put much credence in that idea?
Well, I'll tell you something that's never been written before, and historians might be interested in this, but one day Newt Gingrich was in the lobby of our building, and, you know, we started chatting. I mean, I'd done a number of interviews with him and all that, and he said, "Do you know who I was really talking to on the floor of the House of Representatives when C-SPAN started in 1979, 1980, 81? It had to be 81. And I said, "No, who was it?" He said, "I was talking to the staff at the White House. I wanted the Reagan staff to hear my ideas. That was more important to me than anything." I'd never heard that before, and I've never heard it since, because the general view is that he used that to whip everybody into shape from his point of view, created the Conservative Opportunity Society, then got the leadership in 1995 and went on from there. I don't think there's any question the fact that the House of Representatives went on television was a help to him, and he would say that himself. He said it many times, help to him in getting his message out.
So here's my last question. This is just about my favorite thing with C-SPAN, which is one of my favorite things overall. A presentation or a committee, someone testifying before a committee, will end. And the people who were testifying will think that they're off mic and off screen, but the mics are still on. And the mics pick up snippets of conversation. Do you have a favorite of anything that's ever been said and picked up that way?
Well, I'm going to let Brian answer, but you should have, if you were here in the studio with us, you would have seen him raise his arms up high when you described that, because Brian has been such a champion throughout our 40 years of the before and after the gavel comes down.
Yeah.
So we're gavel to gavel coverage and a little more is what it boils down to. And you really see beyond the facade of the show of Washington when in those moments. Brian, do you have a favorite among them?
Actually, my favorite moment about the last 2 minutes of any hearing was one day I got a call from Meg Greenfield, who was the editorial page editor of the Washington Post. I did not know her. I had never met her. And she said, "Could we have lunch?" And she was very powerful in this town, much more powerful, I think, than the editorial page is today. And I said, "Sure, I'd be glad to. And when we got to lunch, first thing she said to me, "The most important thing about C-SPAN is the last 2 minutes of every hearing." I just love it. And so consequently, that was for me a very strong positive feeling, because I think I got my education in Washington by going in the hearing room and watching it for myself. And when a chairman or a ranking member comes off the dais after they've just been pounding on some witness and goes up and backslaps and shakes hands and knows that the next fundraiser is just around the corner, it's very important for the public to see that. I'll just leave it at that.
And can I tell you, Mike, that when we often, when we hire new producers, it's one of the first things that they want to cut. Because conventional TV rules are the event's over, we're on to the next thing. And we really have to work with people to say, no, 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 let it breathe, let it breathe.
That's the gold.
It's true. And thank you for mentioning it, Mike. That's a victory.
You made Brian's day.
So awesome. The name of the book is The Presidents, Noted Historians Rank America's Best and Worst Chief Executives. It was put together by Brian Lamb and Susan Swain, the founding CEO and co-CEO of C-SPAN, now in its 40th year. Thank you.
What Thank a fun you, conversation. Thank you.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Historians frequently rate the greatest presidents of all time. Lincoln does well, Washington does well, Hoover less so. And when they do, they take into account such qualities as financial stewardship, leadership ability. Those are all fine, fine virtues, but they're not the most important. The name of the book is The Hottest Heads of State. This is Volume 1, The American Presidents, and the authors are the husband and wife team of J.D. and Kate Dobson. Hello, guys.
Hi. Thank you for having us.
So you rate all the presidents on three consistent measures, and then there's sort of a wild card. All the presidents get rated on looks, physique, and charisma, and then you invent a rubric upon which to judge them. How did Grant do in this regard?
Well, as I stall for time and Kate looks it up in our book, Grant does extremely well in looks. He was a very
Obviously.
Handsome man.
Yes.
Charisma, he wasn't a guy who walks into the party and he's the center of attention and he's cracking jokes. He was a more quiet person. He liked to be by himself. So we do not rate him quite as highly on that. We give him a question mark for physique because when he was in the Army, sort of famously and very unlike the, you know, rough and tumble nudity of the 19th century Army, apparently, he wouldn't get naked in front of the other men when they bathed. He insisted on going off by himself. So, you know, the contours of his physique, unfortunately, remain a mystery to historians.
Well, I would surmise back knee.
You must have a historical background yourself. That's you've done your own research into Grant.
Or at least back knee. So you rank all the presidents, like I say, looks, physique, and charisma. And I just want to perhaps nitpick on some of your scores. You give Reagan a 3 on physique. I think of maybe movie star Reagan doing better. Now, at the time, as when he was president, he was in his 70s, the oldest president at the time. So don't you have to norm for that? Why such a low score for Reagan's build?
We rated them on their time in office just because that's the only way we have an even playing field, because we don't really have portraits or photos of all of the presidents when they were younger. And so rating them on their physique when we don't have consistent information about their physique when they were 25.
Yeah.
So yeah, he is penalized for being old, as he should be.
You rate Andrew Johnson an 8 on charisma. How'd you get that?
Well, charisma is such a interesting trait. I mean, I think it is true that it is a thing that exists in the world, and you can objectively say this person is charismatic and this person isn't. But I think it is also true that the charisma of an Obama works on some people and it doesn't work on other people. The charisma right. of a George W. Bush, you know, for some people, his accent says authentic and honest and salt of the earth. And other people, the accent says nails on chalkboard and affectation. And Andrew Johnson was an effective public speaker. He wasn't going to get up there and give sophisticated policy arguments and be stringing really long sentences together, but he was good at whipping up a crowd.
I can't think of anyone else like that. That's weird in our history of our presidency. That's funny.
What president without facial hair would have benefited the most from facial hair, and vice versa?
I am going to throw a couple ideas out here. Herbert Hoover. Mm-hmm. He had a really round face, and I think he would have looked a lot tougher with a beard.
Nice.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I don't know that I could say he would necessarily look better, but the idea of an alternate universe where Ronald Reagan had a big flowing beard just blows my mind, and it's something I would have loved to see.
I think Rutherford B. Hayes definitely should have shaved his beard, because if you see a photo of him without his beard, he is incredibly handsome.
Yes.
And when you see a photo of him with his beard, all you see is just beard. A ton of beard.
And when your name is Rutherford, and especially Rutherford B. Hayes, you just wanna go as unencumbered as you can. Life has weighed you down with accoutrements to begin with. Hottest president, who'd you find?
Well, I think that depends on the taste of the reader, but the answer is Franklin Pierce for everyone.
I think so. I think you're right. He was perpetually young looking.
I don't think it's Pierce. I don't know who I would say it is, but I would say just in the last several administrations, I think Obama is probably better looking than Pierce. I think George W. Bush probably is. I think arguably Bill Clinton is.
Which president started out as the most handsome youth only to curdle into a somewhat disappointing man?
Oh my gosh, there are so many answers to that.
Boy, if you want to keep your looks, do not become president is a tip I would put out there for anybody wanting to stay good looking. My vote would probably be Ford.
Mm.
He was literally a cover model in his youth. And when you look at a photo of Ford as president, probably if you were playing a word association game, you would not think cover model.
Although he probably made more magazine covers as president. I'm just going to guess.
Well, that's a fair point. So if your goal is to get on magazine covers, I do recommend you become president.
Or just make them up yourself and post them in your golf clubs. Okay, so this is Hottest Heads of State, Volume 1, The American Presidents. I have a feeling it's a little like Mel Brooks' History of the World, Part 1. But it does invite the idea, at least in the reader's imagination, of Volume 2, and that would be Heads of State of the World. And I guess the question there is, you know, you got guys like Castro and Mugabe who ran their countries into the ground for 30 years. What era do you take? Just the best looking? You give them the best benefit of the doubt, a la James Garfield?
You know, I think we would do one of two things. We would do either current leaders, which it gets tricky whether you're looking at current leaders or at historical leaders. Those would be the two different approaches. Either way, I kind of hate to write a thing on Mugabe or, you know, leaders. Well, you know, in all seriousness, you hate to trivialize awful dictators by cracking a bunch of jokes about how good looking they are.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny how when we started doing this stuff years ago, you know, we would crack a bunch of jokes about Putin and, oh, doesn't he look silly riding on a horse with no shirt on, ha, ha, ha. And that was kind of – insensitive isn't the right word, but it was thoughtless about, oh, there are actually a lot of people who are suffering and dying because of what this guy's like, and we're cracking jokes about – what a goofball he is.
Well, I guess the closest you'll come to that is the Andrew Jackson jokes.
Well, and we've got a few of those. Coincidentally, we were at the Andrew Jackson site, the Hermitage in Nashville, on the day after the election in 2016. And it was quite an experience touring through the Andrew Jackson Museum and Library, well, the day that our current president was elected.
Did you know that soon he would be citing Jackson as his spiritual forefather?
I think we could sense it. Yeah. I mean, just, you know, they had these big banners up with the hashtag Born for a Storm, and it just looked exactly like something like this is a preview of what the Trump Presidential Museum is going to be like, where they don't really mention the Trail of Tears, or maybe there was like an asterisk somewhere.
Yeah.
A lot of it is about the Battle of New Orleans. He really likes to hang his hat on that.
Couple points, though. Jackson, actual general, and Jackson had accomplishments.
No, it's true. I mean, I think both, yes. there are a lot of similarities between Jackson and Trump, but Jackson, it was important that he won the Battle of New Orleans, important-ish, and he was a successful general. I mean, those were not traits that qualified him to be president, I would argue, but...
And someone who built his way up from just nothing.
Which, I would argue, Donald Trump didn't quite make his way up from nothing.
No, yeah, yeah. J.D. and Kate Dobson are co-authors of The Hottest Heads of State. This is volume one, The American Presidents. Let me just say, of all the books I've read this month, none deliver on their promise so much as this one. Thank you, guys.
Well, thank you. It's early in the month, but thank you so much.
That's it for today's show. The Gist is produced by Corey Wara. The senior producer is Joel Patterson. Michelle Pesca is CLO of Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umpru, gpru, dupru, and thanks for listening.